Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And we greet you from Washington, where the metro used to be on fire, and yesterday it was flooded. So, Jim, we've seen everything pretty much in this political season and in the nation's capital over the past few months here.
You know, Greg, you're really negative. No one gives Metro credit for the fact that the cascading waterfall down the escalators and stairs put out the fire.
If you're planning to visit Washington this summer, you're going to have a lot of fun if you decide to take public transportation. But the fires and the floods actually prepare us for a couple of later martinis, because we do have quite a few biblical references coming up. But we start with the good martini, and we start with news that we pretty much knew was coming for the past few days. And that is that Florida Senator Marco Rubio, after saying when he first announced he was running for president that he would not be trying to keep his Senate seat, and even saying that for months after dropping out of the presidential race, that he will, in fact, seek re-election. The filing deadline is later this week, so he gets in under the gun. We knew this was coming when David Jolly, the congressman from the Tampa area, got out of the race last week and made pretty obvious hints that Rubio was going to do this. Part of me feels a little bit bad for a strong conservative like Ron DeSantis, who's going to be out of Congress unless he really makes a quick pivot back to his House seat. But if you look at the polls, both public and according to some folks internal, Rubio is the only guy who's got a chance to hold the seat for Republicans, and he's got a pretty healthy lead among both Democratic challengers.
I've been trying to sort out how I feel about this, Greg, because on the one hand, I've been a fan of Marco Rubio. There was a lot to applaud in his term in the Senate, some things not to applaud. Obviously, irked quite a few folks who want to see serious immigration reform and border security with what was argued or disputed to be an amnesty proposal in the Gang of Eight bill. But undoubtedly, one of the great talents on the stump goes out and runs for president and doesn't win, loses his home state, and kind of continually does pretty good but not quite good enough on the campaign trail. Then he says, look, this is all or nothing. I was going to be either a president of the United States or a private citizen come January 2017. Chris Saliza of the Washington Post speculates that Rubio had doubts about his future, and Rubio kind of throws this tantrum, might be putting it harsh, but you know, this vehement response. And here we are a couple of weeks later, and no, Rubio's in. Never mind. His justification is that, look, any way you slice it, the next president is going to have to give you reason to worry if you share his perspective. If it's Hillary, there's bad news. If it's Trump, there's bad news. And he wasn't really thinking about Gary Johnson, I guess. And so as a result of that, he says that's what has him choosing to run. He discussed it with his family. On the one hand, if you want to keep your best talent on the field, this is the right thing to do. You pointed out that none of the Republicans who are up against this we're looking that strong against the Democratic opposition. Florida is a big, expensive state, and not an easy one for Republicans to win, particularly in a presidential turnout year. Rubio gives him the best shot. And if you think Rubio had a great talent and great potential, you like to see him staying in the game. Having said that, he'd been pretty vehement about this. And I think it's safe to say the Democrats will be throwing this at him from now until November.
Well, yeah, he'll have to answer for a few different things, including that. It's interesting from the polls that have come out, Quinnipiac most recently, is that both of the Democratic candidates, there's Patrick Murphy, who defeated Alan West a few years back in the Palm Beach area, and the insane Alan Grayson, both have a lead over all the other Republicans currently in the race. But Marco Rubio has a comfortable 7-8 point, maybe even 9 point lead against both of them. Interestingly, against Rubio, Murphy and Grayson poll almost exactly the same. So basically, after the whole Charlie Crist experiment as a Democrat in 2014, Florida Democrats will pretty much vote for anyone with a D next to their name, won't they?
There was going to be a really tragic, cruel irony if January 2017 began with Charlie Crist in Congress and Marco Rubio not.
Yes.
As if the election gods had kind of said to us, say, we're going to undo 2010 and just really mess with you. For those of us who think that the Democrats all kind of march in lockstep, this is a piece of evidence in support of that, because Patrick Murphy, for all of his flaws, is not as obnoxious and just as toxic as Alan Grayson. I'm sure Alan Grayson would probably yell at us and call us names because of that. Patrick Murphy is, you know, when they do polling for a generic Democrat, they're really asking about Patrick Murphy. Whereas Alan Grayson is like the comment section come to life. I mean, Donald Trump could say, Alan Grayson, you have no decorum, no manners, and you really need to behave more professionally in this world of politics. And yet the fact they're doing both the same kind of indicates that for Florida Democrats, yeah, he's on our team, it's fine. Oh, Charlie Crist, we've been voting against him for a decade. That's fine. He's got a D after his name. We don't care. So that's what we have to look forward to. Hopefully Rubio will run, will win, and maybe provide, you know, maybe seasoning and experience will kind of help him overcome the flaws he's demonstrated in an unsuccessful presidential campaign.
If you're Rubio, do you want Grayson to win? Probably, right? The Democratic primary? That's high risk, high reward,
yes.
Because if you actually lose
high
to
risk,
him, it's crazy.
Reward, right?
Yes.
Technically, he should be easier to beat, but man, if you end up losing it, that's like, you know, we joked that when he ran against Webster, it was the devil and Daniel Webster.
Yes.
That basically now we'd have a situation of just the most horrible person in American politics beating the guy who was once touted on Time magazine as a Republican savior. Democrats would be getting a lot of cackling about that. So
yes, they most certainly would. Okay, on to a double-barreled bad martini now. And for that, we go back to the wonderful work of our Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, as well as the Federal Bureau of Investigation, but mostly Loretta Lynch today. After all of her great work earlier this week redacting the 911 calls where it's blatantly obvious what Omar Mateen is pledging allegiance to, even though it said it was omitted, she finally relented. The new unredacted transcripts came out, and he obviously is pledging allegiance to ISIS and al-Baghdadi. Yesterday, she's in Orlando at a press conference with even more pathetic statements. First of all, after those transcripts have now come forth and it's obvious that he only declared his motivation to be one thing, Loretta Lynch offers this as to the motivation for the Orlando terrorist attack.
You know, whenever you look at someone's motivation or intent, whether they're living or whether they're dead, you look at their actions and their activities surrounding the event. You look at what they said, you look at what they did. You look at how they behaved, and you come up with the most reasonable interpretation, the one that fits the facts there. And so we do feel that as we continue to build a timeline and a chronology and to build his life, that we will be able to determine this. I cannot tell you definitively that we will ever narrow it down to one motivation.
Don't listen to him. We don't know what happened, why he did this. And then, of course, the other key figure that we want to know more about is the wife. She could obviously help to shed more light on this. What's the latest with her, Attorney General Lynch?
Right now, I do not know exactly the answer to that. I believe she was going to travel, but I do not know exactly her location now.
We don't know where she is. Jim, this is a bang-up job by our law enforcement at the federal level.
I was going to say, I understand my husband just killed close to 50 people. I told him not to do it, but I did not call 911. I did nothing to really stop him. I'm the person most familiar with his thinking and actions before he perpetrated the massacre. I'm going to go take a trip. Is that okay with you guys? Sure, no problem. You know, she can't even say she's going to Disney World. This was a big portion of today's morning jolt, and I don't like whacking around the FBI. I don't like whacking around law enforcement. I want to believe that the Department of Justice is full of smart, skilled professionals operating within the law who want to do their best to protect us. But it's really unnerving to see this kind of stuff. And Lynch's statement of, oh, it could be anything, you know, oh, you know, we just don't know. Like, what? Why is his declaration at the on the phone? What do you think? Is it a lie? A cover story? He didn't really want to join ISIS? I mean, it just defies all logic here. And it just comes across as this heavy-handed, we want to believe it's not ISIS, we want to believe it's not really an Islamist terror, and as a result of that, we're going to pretend to not see that. We're going to avert our eyes, and we're going to speculate that it's repressed, he might have been gay, he's got his homophobia, and in a bad relationship with his father, and everything except the reason he gave during the attack. And it just seems like this willful blindness, to use the book title of my colleague Andy McCarthy, and it just is a... You can't feel confident when you see law enforcement officials insisting that, no, it's not what you think it is. It's totally Shinola.
And the same problem happens in the lead up to it because the FBI doesn't want to profile, and they let him off the hook after very suspicious information and then failed to follow up after the threat from Disney and the warning from the gun shop that denied this guy his heavy body armor and the bulk ammo. So this willful blindness both before and after, it's going to get a lot of people killed. But fortunately, Loretta Lynch has the answer to terrorism.
Our most effective response to terror and to hatred is compassion, it's unity, and it's love.
Now, biblically speaking, as an individual, we're called to forgive the unforgivable, turn the other cheek, love our enemies. As a nation, we're supposed to kick the crap out of them, Jim, so I'm not sure what her policy is here.
Greg, I want to love our enemies so much it could split an atom.
You want to love them like OJ loved Nicole, huh?
Well done, Rumpus. That was our spit take moment of today's podcast. And I will probably steal that joke as soon as we're done taping. Again, this is Hallmark card stuff. You don't want to hear that from the nation's first chief law enforcement officer and someone who's presumably has a great deal of responsibility of stopping terror attacks and then, you know, catching them when they occur.
Do you think if there's any other motivation in the tape that wasn't released, we would have heard it? If it was anti-gay or if it was anything else, that they would have plastered that all over instead of just trying to redact pathetically what they did redact?
Something I'm kind of wondering about.
Look, you know, the report came out that somebody came out and said they had a man said he had a sexual relationship with Mateen. People said they'd seen him at the club before and he didn't seem to be casing the joint. He seemed to be drinking and out to meet people. Apparently he was on social media for gays. You know, it's entirely possible the guy had all kinds of deep-rooted issues of personal identity and sexual identity and all that kind of stuff. But one, he certainly didn't mention it when he did that. And here's the thing. There are a lot of people in America who apparently have that. This is not the first closeted gay person in the entire world. However, I'd like to think America doesn't have that many people who've pledged loyalty to Baghdadi and ISIS. That's what makes him unique. That's what makes him special. So I don't think we really need to worry about, look out for all those repressed gay men out there. I think we have to say, hey, look out for all those people who want to join ISIS. That seems like the more relevant focus here, because I don't believe, as bad as this was, I don't believe that anti-gay attitudes automatically turn you into a mass murdering maniac. Whereas I think once you start saying, yeah, I'm on board with Baghdadi and ISIS, then I think your propensity to violence, the percentages go up a great deal.
Jim, we spent a lot of the second martini talking about people who refuse to see the facts and who just see what they want to believe and try to project that. Let's move to the crazy martini. Evangelicals have supported Donald Trump in much larger numbers than anyone probably expected. And some prominent evangelical figures even got on board with Trump when there were far better options on the table from their perspective. That includes Jerry Falwell Jr. He kind of led the contingent of evangelical figures up in New York yesterday to meet with Trump. Some of these are actually pretty respectable figures like Jim Dobson and Richard Land and other pastors who have strong reputations. There are also some prosperity gospel hucksters up there and other people who are more on the political side. But Donald Trump had him there. He told him what he was going to tell him on Judges. He promised he was pro-life and all these sorts of things, which he has done along the way. And if he turns out to be right, that's great. But the instant acceptance of this, given Trump's long track record being completely in the opposite direction on all these issues that have been so important to social conservatives for years, has me spinning my head. And it also caught up with Jerry Falwell Jr., the head of Liberty University, who posed for Trump along with Falwell's wife. And next to Falwell's wife on the wall in Trump's office is a cover of Playboy magazine in which Trump did an interview. So Falwell obviously gets a lot of grief about that. And then he tweets out, "Honored for same hypocrites to accuse Jesus of being a friend of publicans and sinners to be targeting me over a decades-old magazine cover. Thank you." Jerry, first of all, you're not Jesus. Secondly, I'm pretty sure when Jesus met with the sinners, he did extend grace to them and love to them, but he didn't go out and cheerlead for them and tell tax collectors and prostitutes, well, hey, look at all the jobs you're creating for the economy. So clearly you're a faithful person.
We are going to make Judea great again, my friend. Look, I kind of feel for these evangelical leaders because they clearly did not expect to be in this situation. They're used to having Republican nominees who they can be very comfortable with, who are reliably pro-life, who have kind of, you know, strong ties to the religious faith communities and who don't usually get forced into this situation. And I understand the desire, okay, Donald Trump is not our guy. He used to own strip clubs. He ragged about affairs with married women in his books. He's always been, you know, and right in front of Trump Tower, I don't know if you've seen the giant statue of the golden calf they have. he doesn't seem like our guy. But, you know, they go, they meet with him. They don't want to be seen as unfairly rejecting him or not giving him a chance. Clearly, they want to like him. They want to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I think that for all of Trump's flaws, It's not that I think Trump has ever actively rejected Christianity or the values or anything like that. I think he just simply hasn't thought about any of them. Or perhaps he sees God as a peer. I don't know if that's the right way to characterize the Trump religious philosophy. But so you go there and you have the meeting and they want to do a photo op. Okay, fine. And, you know, Trump puts on his traditional thumbs up and giant artificial smile. But was there nobody in the room who could say, can we just move a little to the left? Little, just away from the Playboy cover. Okay, yeah. Remember that magazine my dad fought with for all those years? Yeah, can we just step? There we go. That's good. Nobody had that. They couldn't crop the photo. And worst of all, he's got his wife right in front of it. And it's just – this is why an advanced team would be like, whoa, let's take a look at this first. So,
but here's the thing. If you think Hillary Clinton is guaranteed 100% lockstep against your agenda, you're right. You're right. And you think that Donald Trump, even though he's probably not that good, will probably stumble into a few things that are much more – to your liking than Hillary would, that argument I can stomach. The idea that he comes out and gives about a 5 or 10 minute presentation and everybody's like, oh, okay, we're on board.
Yeah. It's a conversion at the road to Damascus, Greg. It's one of those things where I'm trying to come up with metaphors and they sound like puns, but I'm not trying to make a pun.
Right.
Honest to goodness, this is a leap of faith on their part.
Sure it is.
They are choosing to believe that Trump, if elected, will just get better, that he will be a wiser person, a more appropriately temperamental person, that he will grow in office and he'll kind of grow into what Christians want to see in a president. And I hope so, too. You know, if it comes to that to pass, that's certainly what I'd like to see happen to Trump. And maybe it's worth some prayers, but you also kind of have to look at evidence and you know, contemplate, you know, yes, past performance isn't always indicative of future results, but you don't want to ignore that stuff either. Anyway, it's a leap of faith that I'm just looking at that ledge and saying, I don't like those heights.
I'm sure he's going to pivot once he gets in office, just like he pivoted right after he clinched the nomination.
Pivot, just like a pirouetting ballerina.
Depressing, but at least some good news today. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.